Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. The Australian Navy divers are one of the most elite military forces in the world. This is what a Navy diver must be able to do. They've got to be able to operate underwater in perfect silence, in cold, murky water, and by touch alone, they've got to be able to defuse a mine that's powerful enough to sink a battleship. Often these mines are deliberately constructed with a trick fuse that's designed to detonate if they're tampered with. That means, in fact, they are designed to kill the Navy diver himself. These divers are also trained for counter-terrorist operations and to board pirate ships and shut them down. The origins of this branch lie in the Second World War, when they were created to dismantle one of Hitler's so-called secret weapons. Well, Gregor Salmon is here. He's returning to Conversations today. He's told the story of the Navy divers in a book called Navy Divers, The Incredible Story of the Australian Navy's Elite Unit. Hello, Gregor. Welcome back.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me.
Of course, my first thought upon reading about this in the intensive training course is that guys like you and I could do this. We just choose not to.
That's right. Yeah,
we've got other things to do, but we could do it, couldn't we? I mean, easy.
If you want to feel very unfit and flabby, go and watch these guys do their training.
So you did this, did you? You watched them train for the Navy diver course.
Yeah, I went to a few phases of their training. The first part was the selection, which is basically an endurance test to see whether you've got what it takes to proceed into the basic clearance divers course.
And where do you have to be to even begin, you know, to apply? What level do you have to be in the Navy to begin with? I'm assuming.
Well, you have to enlist. You have to join the Navy, and then say this is what you want to do. And it changes depending on whether they need to recruit divers into the branch or not. You would join the Navy and then basically do a few courses while you waited for the next round of selection to come on. And so while you're doing that, most of the guys were down at HMAS Cerberus in Victoria, and they would train in preparation for taking the selection course. So they knew the basic sort of requirements that you had to be, pretty much be able to run all day, do these palm out chin-ups and sit-ups, and that was the basic requirement. So they would, the guys down there would train together and just make sure that they could exceed that. But they'd turn up to the course, and then basically for the next 10-12 days, very little sleep, one round of exhausting activity after another.
Is it an endurance test and a skill test, or just endurance pretty much?
It's both. It's quite halfway through the course. It's quite apparent that it's not just a physical endurance test. It's the mental strength to be able to keep on going and to never give up. And so these guys, there aren't many people who are around who are fitter. And halfway through the course, they're just zombies. They're kind of walking dead, and they're just able to focus on the next evolution, the next task, and not much beyond that. Mind power is required for them to just get through the next phase.
Right. So they've just got to basically get through it without falling over and passing out, and they've got to stay sane as well in the process.
Yeah.
So when you were watching guys fall down though during this process too.
Well, I saw guys pull out. One guy's leg, thigh muscle just sort of blew out on him. Another guy slipped in the kitchen and fell on his back and put his back out. And And so they were sort of forced out.
What does it do to them when they're forced out like that? Just shattered them, I suppose.
They're gutted, you know. It gets very, very deep into their psychology about what it is they really want to do with their life. Do they really want to do this? And, you know, at some point, you know, if they may have made a decision. Well, I'm not going to go on. This is too much. I'm giving up.
So men and women can do it, can't they? Like, because Martina Jewell, who was on here recently, did this course. So I don't suppose there are many women there, but there are women there, aren't there?
Well, that was news to me. I didn't, as far as I knew, it was an all guy thing. Whether she's actually qualified to become a clearance diver or she's doing that at the moment, doing the basic clearance diver course, I'm not sure.
Right. Maybe I got that detail wrong, I think. But as I recall, she mentioned she'd done it as part of her training. It's such an intense thing, though. I just wonder what it's like for those who do pass, and how many out of the group do pass anyway.
Well, the squad that I saw, there was 22, I think, that started, and 13 got through the CDAT course, which is the clearance divers acceptance test, which is just the selection course. 13 got through that. Then you go into 9 months of your basic training, your apprenticeship, if you like, where you learn how to become a clearance diver. You learn, you know, all the different dive kits that they use. You learn about explosive ordnance disposal and various other things. So it's the apprenticeship. And that is considered to be, you know, even tougher than the selection course, because it's over 9 months, and you'll have episodes where they get just as little sleep, and they're always put under the torch to be the kind of people who haven't had 2 days sleep but can still, you know, have the have the brain power and the determination to stay switched on enough to make the right choices, diffusing a mine.
Yeah, well, why do they need to do that? Because, you know, when they're sent in, it's often they're quite fully refreshed, aren't they, after they've had plenty of sleep or they're there to diffuse. Why do you think they put them under this kind of pressure before they even let them begin?
Because it ultimately comes down to them acting independently. They've got to be trusted to be able to make the right call under extreme duress. I guess it's quite unique in the armed forces, where, you know, rather than have a bunch of guys who can confer and make a decision, a diver underwater in that kind of element often means that he's going to be by himself and has to make a decision to do something. And the best way to make sure that he makes the right decision is to put him through this kind of course.
Gregor Salmon is my guest, Sydney writer. His latest book is about the Australian Navy divers, one of the most elite military forces in the world. Now, this is what I didn't know so much about the divers. One of the things is that they came out of the Second World War initially in response to rumours of Hitler's secret weapon, which was thought to be a death ray to begin with. I love that. That's so sci-fi. Yeah. Hitler's death ray. But it wasn't. It was much more mundane and horrible than that, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, there was another rumor that it was some kind of spiderweb substance that if you touched was poisonous. But no,
it's poisonous. Yeah. Right. So Hitler, the first supervillain in that sense, in the James Bond way. Yeah.
But it was the magnetic mine, which during the initial stages of the Second World War. While there were no significant land battles being fought, Germany had embarked on a blockade of Britain, and using their latest cutting edge mine, which is the magnetic mine, and the Brits suspected that this is what they were using, but they just weren't able to retrieve one because. Their minesweeping capability was designed to take care of the
conventional mines, the ones that were on buoys, so they were floating just below the surface. What was this magnetic mine, and what made it different to the old fashioned mines that used to hang off a buoy?
It stayed on the bottom of the seabed. It rested on the seabed, and once it was armed, it took a kind of an imprint a reading of its surrounding magnetic field. And once that field was disturbed by...
Well, the hull of a ship.
Hull of a ship, you know. Yeah. All ships have a sort of a magnetic signature. And so once its sensor detects the a magnetic force that a ship would create, it detonates.
And what effect would that have, given that it's at the bottom of the seabed or it's in the channel or somewhere like that, given that it's so far below, would it still do major damage to shipping?
Incredibly, yeah, because what the effect is, it's a bubble jet effect, so that the mine explodes, this intense outpouring of energy, converts into basically a battering ram. So it detonates just as it detonates right under the ship. The explosion, the bubble from the explosion, rises very quickly upwards, and underneath that is this battering ram, like a column of water, which is strong enough to lift a ship out of the water.
Lift it out of the water?
Yeah.
What, and then smash it in two? Right.
Yeah, well, it has this sort of pincer effect. So it pushes it up and then it sinks back down into a bit of a pothole. And so with these ships, they weren't welded. They were bolted together. And so all the rivets would be, between the panels would just be loosened by the severe kind of jackknife effect. And then... water would just pour in, and
so if this campaign had worked to surround Britain with mines and isolate it and blockade it, that would have been the end of Britain in the war, wouldn't it? I mean, because it was so completely reliant on being resupplied from other countries, like the United States and for Australia and other parts of the world as well.
Yeah, well, Churchill had said that Hitler had obviously been told that this tactic would compass our ruin, and so. And it was having a devastating result. They were, as an island, they needed to have, food, arms. That was their lifeblood. The merchant ships, the passage of their navy, it was their defensive lifeblood, and also that's what they needed to survive.
So they found one that had been sort of washed up in an estuary or something, and figured out how to defuse it. How then did that? What did the Royal Navy do then in order to begin the creation, if you like, of something that eventually became the Australian Navy Divers?
Well, the defence for the mine.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They had these degaussing girdles, which were basically wires that were placed around the ship, which counteracted the magnetic field of the ship, so neutralised the magnetic field of the ship, so it wouldn't trigger the mine. But from the Second World War, all sorts of things happened with diving during the Second World War, and they were they had to sort of develop diving kits to clear the ports after the D-Day landings. They needed to clear the occupied ports and of mines and that kind of stuff. And so they there was a bit of a technological developments that allow them to develop kits and diving gear to do these jobs. And there's a whole bunch of different kind of diving activities that were that developed during the Second World War, and Britain at the end of it just sort of said, okay, well, let's consolidate these types of skills, and we'll create a clearance diving branch, and then Australia did the same.
Yeah, but Australians were right there at the beginning, weren't they? It was largely Australians who became the first Navy divers operating for the Royal Navy, the British Navy, as it was.
Yeah, well, there were three. Three or four guys who played a very significant role in all this. They were volunteers. The Australian Navy weren't sending sailors to this area at this time.
So why Australians? Was it a coincidence, or was it did they like the pluck of the Australian character, or was that too romantic?
Well, I think there's a bit of that, because. In Ivan Southall's book, Softly Tread the Brave, it said that the director of mines, who was a South African bloke, he'd heard that a bunch of Australians had arrived, and he figured that they'd be sort of game enough and stupid enough or courageous enough to volunteer for for mine disposal. It had to volunteer for it. It was a special operation.
We were either brave enough or stupid enough. Yeah. That's amazing. So why were some of these men so happy to volunteer? One of them, you know, went on to be was part of the Syme family, who was, you know, who were the owners of the Melbourne Age. And why would they be happy to go for this nerve-wracking, terrifying work of getting into the water and defusing these mines?
Well, I spoke to a British guy, Noel Cashford, who was taught by these guys, and he said they weren't happy about it at all. But he said that, you know, they just sort of got on with the job because they volunteered for special operations inland, but they weren't really sure exactly what they were going to do. And it's only once they started the training, once they put their hand up and were selected, that they were told that, okay, well, what we're going to train you to do is to take apart these mines.
The good news or the bad news? Right, you're defusing mines from now on.
Yeah.
Some of them liked well, I don't know if like is probably a strong word, isn't it? But thought that, you know, their comrades were sort of going in to fight the enemy and getting maimed or in the process or dying agonising deaths. I suppose they figured that they don't get maimed, but if they get killed, it's in an instant.
Yeah, that was it. That was
quick, clean death.
The end would be quick. And once they got off over their significant fear, it became an intellectual exercise. You know, that they became fascinated with what the enemy were doing because. What they were looking at when they'd strip a mine, they'd see how the enemy was thinking, and so it became this kind of, a psychological joust, if you like, between the Nazi engineers and these guys,
the evil geniuses behind these mines. So as they learned how to defuse one magnetic mine, then Hitler's engineers would make it more complicated and make the fuse add trick fuses. So to trip these guys up. So in that sense, it was a weird battle of wits between these guys underwater and some engineer in somewhere in Germany.
Yeah, well, they had because once they successfully had taken a mine apart, they could reverse engineer it and you could work out a way for your ships to avoid being blown up by it. So then the Germans would have to come up with something else. So it was an ever-advancing reaction-action kind of process. And so
the point was not to let it get reverse-engineered then.
Yeah,
so to make sure it would get destroyed.
Yeah.
If anyone tried to tamper with it.
So that's why they started targeting the mine disposal guys.
So they targeted the divers as a threat to their war effort in that sense by making these mines more and more elaborate.
Well, initially they weren't divers. Because this was all on land. Because because they started to drop these mines during the Blitz, the Germans had struck upon the sort of the power of demoralizing power of these parachute mines going off during built up areas, and so it was these guys were sent in to clean up during the Blitz, so they're going into cities and to defuse naval mines that have been rigged to go off when they land on the ground, and then later they had to once the Blitz was over and the Germans returned to drop in most of their mines in the water, they had to develop scuba gear to deal with those mines underwater. That they became harder to find. You know,
Gregor Salmon is here. His book is called Navy Divers: The Incredible Story of the Australian Navy's Elite Unit. I remember this stuff from that 1970s BBC series Danger UXB, which I used to watch as a kid, with Anthony Andrews as this young officer sent in to defuse some of these mines. After he defused his first bomb, he sort of was told, "Well done, sir," by the men, and walked away and then vomited. How were the men after they'd successfully defused one of these mines? Were they elated or just sick to their stomach, I wonder?
I think relief would be the word, you know, that they're still alive and kicking. I think, they would have a sense of victory because
they'd save lives. You know, they'd save lives.
It's, yeah.
Without hurting anyone, I suppose. You know, there is that. You know, yeah.
And they've thwarted the enemy. I think it's a battle that they've won, and it's so I think there's that sense of having won this little battle within the war. And
so it's terrifying but deeply satisfying work for many of them.
Yeah, and I think that's it carries through to, you know, the guys who are in Afghanistan today.
Then Hitler came up with the acoustic mine. What was different about that? How did that work? That was what made that thing detonate?
Well, it was a.
When I say Hitler, I mean his people came up with this. Yeah. Not Hitler himself. He wasn't working away on these on his own. But how did these work?
Well, it was like a microphone in the mine now. So it would respond to some sort of acoustic signature that a ship would give out. So, and then they started combining. You know, it was an acoustic magnetic mine. So it was armed by a particular sound, and then it would go off as a ship passed over it.
Right. So they had to work silently, and if they wanted to defuse those.
Yeah, because the way to deal with the magnetic mines was to drag a cable behind a ship that imitated replicated the magnetic. It was basically a string of magnets that created a magnetic field that was similar to that of a ship to trick the mine into detonating.
After the war, they were kind of constituted as an official unit within the Australian Navy in the post-war years, and then they were called to a job. I love this story. Called to a job. In the Snowy Mountains, Lake Eucanbean. Tell me about the job there and what they were called to do.
Well, the guys who did the job had no idea really, you know, what they were in for. But what had happened was the Eucanbean Dam had been constructed, but it started to fill up a bit earlier than expected. And what had happened was the dam essentially is, it's an earth wall built across a valley which holds back about enough water to fill Sydney Harbour nine times over, something like that. And to let the water out, the water should pass through this sieve, like this tall column, which filters out all the logs and trees and debris and that kind of stuff to allow clean water to pass out of the tunnel into pipes and down to turbines to generate electricity. This dam filled up a bit sooner than expected because the engineers had found that they couldn't open. There was a mechanism by which they could shut the water off and come in through the tunnel and work maintenance on the bottom of this straining tower. Anyway, so what happened was it was leaking. And so they had to call in divers to find out what the problem was to fix the problem, basically. But by the time they put the call out to the divers, the straining tower was something like 16 metres tall, and by this stage it was something like 20 metres underwater. So they had to dive over 100 metres down to get a look at what the problem was. And a French company had said, look, okay, we'll do it for £1 million. We want that up front and we want £1 million after we're done and without any guarantee of success. And, of course, they weren't going to pay for that. And so they got the divers on board and they skimped on that depth. They should have been using mixed gas, but helium was too expensive. So they said, "Well, we can do this on air." So the divers these Australian divers would go down and find out what was causing the problem, and they're going to do it on air. And that introduced a whole bunch of problems because of the problems of narcosis.
Oh, nitrogen narcosis. Mm. Yeah. And when you're on that, when you've got a head full of nitrogen, it feels like, you get drunker and drunker. It's like you've drunk one martini, two martinis, and then eventually by the time you get down that far, it's like you've had 10 martinis.
Yeah, that's right.
So how can they possibly do the work when they've effectively had 10 martinis and they've got to go down and find out what's going on there and look after themselves too?
Yeah, well, they only two guys were able to, by some sort of freak of their genetic makeup, were able to do the work. All the team had been tested in chambers up in Sydney, you know, to depths, and made sure that, you know, and they'd passed the test up in Sydney. None of them had suffered narcosis, but they went down to the job, and you know, they could only spend 15 minutes at the bottom before they would have to come up and spend like an hour and a half, you know, decompressing. And but once they sort of got onto the job, only two guys were able to sort of function, because, you know, some guys would be down there and say, yep, I've tied this onto that, you lift it up, you know, and the crane would lift up a piece of rope. He hadn't actually tied it on.
Anything on there, right.
So they're
hallucinating.
They're in La La Land.
Yeah, they're in La La Land.
And so two guys were able to function, you know, well enough to get the job done.
That's why we have Lake Yucumbine today. You can get hydroelectric power from it, because they unclogged the sieve, essentially, did they?
That's right, yeah.
Pull bits of old tyre out of the whole thing.
Yeah, I think it was embarrassing for the engineers, because as they saw the dam rise, they started to throw all this junk in down the sieve to try and you know,
clog it up. One thing was quite enlightening, Gregor, was the work that they did during the Vietnam War. Now, I didn't figure they'd have much of a role there, but of course they did. So this is mainly harbour work they were doing there, wasn't it? Like clearing mines out of harbours.
Well, it was more checking, and that's how it started. That they were there to in Vung Tau Harbour, where a lot of the ships would come before, you know, making the trip up to Saigon. They'd be anchored in harbour, and they became sort of, you know, targets for saboteurs. And
very they were effectively sabotaged too, weren't they? I mean, they were using all kinds of limpet mines in order to destroy the shipping there.
Yeah. So their initial role was to sort of, you know, was the safety of the harbour, and so they're doing these hull checks and checking on anchor anchor cables and that kind of stuff. But once the Americans sort of cottoned on to what they could do, they were called out to all sorts of, you know, operations, and you know, so that's the nature of their job there changed.
Yeah, in what way? It meant they were going on to land a lot more for a start, and doing land clearance work.
Yeah, because they're explosives experts, so that means demolitions, and they were taken. Taken along to do things like, you know, to destroy bunkers. You know, that the once the Americans had started to patrol in the Mekong Delta, they were copying harassment fire and rocket fire from the Viet Cong. You know, because they're quite narrow channels, so you're running the gauntlet every time they're on patrol.
Were they trained at that point to deal with that kind of close quarters kind of combat and with guns? It's kind of more of an army thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, they were pretty much there to sort of they would carry explosives in and to take care of they had their guns and that kind of stuff, and they were given training in combat before they left. But it wasn't really the kind of role that they were expecting to take. You know, to be going on, you know, on these sorts of patrols. You know, though they were sort of ambush. Operations sometimes.
I love the fact that they were being trained to dismantle all kinds of things, like from sophisticated Russian-made mines to primitive booby traps.
Yeah, well, they had, you know, so because the Viet Cong would take, say, you know, an artillery shell and then rig it to, you know, to take your legs off, you know, if you stepped in the pit and trot on the tripwire. And so they...
A lot of Gilligan's Island stuff too, you know, like... Spears dipped in, you know, in feces that were sort of, you know, sprung to come out and spear you if you trot on something. And I mean, it's amazing stuff.
Yeah, it was kind of medieval. And I think the guys who, no matter, because there were eight contingents that went over over a period of 4 years, and no matter what the experience was gained, I think they were all on a steep learning curve once they got there. You know, because, you know, before that war, there was, you know, the idea of explosive ordnance disposal was really still geared towards your, you know, your World War II ordnance, your British, American, Japanese, German mines, and this was a whole new ball game.
After they came back, like many people returning from Vietnam, they were often greeted with stony silence or the desire by people just not to even, don't mention the war, or occasionally hostility as well. What did that do to them as a unit? I wonder, did it make them they were already, you know, had a sense of how elite they were. Did it make them a kind of a more closed unit?
Well, I think it became an individual thing, I think, because, you know, even within the dive branch, there were, you know, there was, it wasn't like they came back and everyone, all their peers were saying, oh, how was it? What did you get up to? That kind of stuff. Even within the dive branch, you know, some of these guys experienced, you know, sort of, you know, no one wanted to know, no one wanted to ask them anything about, you know, their experiences. They felt a sense of isolation even within the Navy. And so,
even within the Navy too.
Well, they also kind of like, well, they were sort of would come back and then sort of saying, oh, you know, here you go, you're on leave for a couple of weeks and this is where you need to turn up and in 2 weeks' time for your next posting. So on all sorts of fronts, there was that sense, I guess, of I guess being, it must have been surreal to have come from the conflict and then to come back to a country which was either didn't care or, you know, was hostile to the idea that you'd been to Vietnam.
Given that the US military called upon them again and again and again to do very different kinds of work, were they appreciative of the work done by the Navy divers?
Extremely so. You know, they considered these guys as to be one of their own units, essentially. They were actually given a title of, they were one of the American explosive ordnance disposal units. So they were kitted out by the Americans. They, you know, when the phone rang, it was normally the Americans on the end of the line wanting to do a job. They would do jobs for the Australians, no problems. But the Americans ended up giving them awarding them something like 3 unit citations, and these basically ended up in the bottom of some filing cabinet for 40 odd years.
Well, they were just forgotten about. So they weren't awarded in the 1970s because someone had just shelved them and no one had done anything about it.
Yeah, it wasn't officially recognised until last year.
Last year? There was a ceremony last year in which these men were presented with their commendations from the US Navy.
Oh, it might have been earlier this year.
Earlier this year, okay. Then things changed once again in the 1970s when there was the Hilton bombing in Sydney during the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in 1978. And there was suddenly a perceived a role for the Navy divers in counter-terrorism. And they were brought in together with the SAS, weren't they? So one part of the counter-terrorist force was the SAS, and the Navy divers were sort of brought into that. How did they get on, the SAS and the Navy divers?
Well, it was, yeah, not well at first. You know, I think, you know, understandably, the SAS, it was, you know, they saw it as their, as it was their role. They ran it. They ran the training over in Perth.
So the divers were kind of seconded to them then, rather than them having their own diving unit.
Yeah, because one, you know, one aspect of what the British had done was they developed a counterterrorism force that could retake things like ships and oil platforms, and, you know, and Australia wanted that capacity as well. And that required a level of diving and boat expertise, boat infiltration expertise that the SAS didn't have. And the Navy divers were the only part of the Defence Force that did. So they were sent over. Well, you know, there was a selection process. Guys went over and they would do... initially, they did a version of the Carter course, which is the legendary SAS selection course.
They kept getting failed, didn't they? Navy guys kept getting failed.
Well, they passed that, but after that was the counter-terrorism training. You know, some of which was the...
Like going into a room with guns, being able to do all that, yeah.
Yeah, making, you know, storming a room, you know, face mask on, you know, having to discern between a hostage and a terrorist and shooting the right people and that kind of stuff and not pointing a weapon at anyone. There was certain... The Navy divers found themselves basically being failed at one point or another during the training to become counter-terrorists. And so I think all but from, I think from 20, basically there was a high failure, 8 out of 10 say were failed at this stage. And so the diving branch were left scratching their heads thinking, come on, our guys aren't that sort of inept. Surely. But it wasn't until the divers started to do the full Carter course Even though the course that they had done was extremely tough and the SAS had modified it just for them and they didn't make it easy, they started to do the full Carter course, and the first 2 years that they did that, a Navy diver topped the Carter course. So they started to win some respect. It got to the stage where, you know, they were, you know, they're side by side, you know, with the Army guys in the counterterrorism unit, and with no real issues at all.
Then after the breakout of the first Gulf War, when Saddam Hussein's forces invaded Kuwait, there's amazing stories there of the kind of conditions that Navy divers were sent in to work in there. We remember that time when after Saddam Hussein his army was pushed out of Kuwait, he set the oil wells on fire and the skies around there were full of black smoke. And there's the Australian Navy divers being sent in to clear the Kuwaiti harbours there. Just astonishing to think of what that work was like.
Yeah, well, that was UNCASAR, I think, was the first port they went into. And this was back to the real core role, you know, was to be able to get in the water, can't see a thing, and be able to guarantee that this port is going to be clear for a ship, all ships to use. That they won't be, you know, a mine's not going to go off. So that means basically covering the seabed in this port inch by inch. And the Australians had retained that skill, which had sort of been developed in the Second World War, and
working by touch, working by feel. What, so they'd find their way forward, and if they found anything,
well, they call their fingers their ten eyes. You know, that they have to basically feel their way around, you know, a mine and to find its various components that they can access and then work on.
They were very effective, very, very quick at clearing areas. Much more, they cleared more area than US, Canadian and British divers combined. Well, why was that? Why were they so effective?
Because they had retained this swimming string, which is the, you know, where you lay down a piece of string on the seabed and you sweep up and down on either side of it. And so you know exactly that area is clear of all potential hazards. And so it's a procedural kind of exercise. They would go through and methodically clear these areas of seabed. And the Americans and the British hadn't retained that, which is a very kind of, it sounds very rudimentary, and it is. But sometimes, even with dolphins around, you know, you're going to have to have a diver down there with his bare hands feeling to see what's what. Yeah, so and that's what they are very good at.
Yeah, I suppose the lesson was absorbed by the United States and the British Armed Forces, because they went ahead and made their own Navy diver units after this to replicate the Australian unit.
Yeah, and I think that was the kind of it's that kind of experience that sort of lifts the branch and makes it have renewed faith in what it is they do and their capabilities.
They had a role in the Iraq War as well, in 2003, clearing a port there. Divers found some mines there. They found a sunken mine layer beside a wharf with four live mines on its trolleys. Incredible pressure they were working under there to clear the port.
Well, yeah, that was, the name escapes me, but that might be UNCASAR rather than the other one. I'm sorry if that's wrong, but they had to. They were kind of, I guess, in the center of a political and humanitarian and a crisis where there was a great need for there to be a humanitarian side to this invasion.
So they had to clear the wharf to get a supply ship in.
Yeah, because Iraqis were starving. There'd been blockades, and they had sort of food on these ships waiting to come in, and then all of a sudden the Australians with their very first dive discover these mines.
This was this time when famously those dolphins were brought in to help with the mine clearing effort. Was that real? Was any of that real? Was that genuine? Were the dolphins doing any real good there, or was that just publicity? Was that?
The dolphins are terrific in that they it's almost like they can sort of separate the wheat from chaff, you know, because their sensitivity in terms of their sonar it allows them to be far more kind of hone in on what is likely to be a hazardous object. And, you know, as I said before, the process for humans, you know, is to go methodically and use your hands if you have to. And whereas the dolphins can sort of hone in on something. And what they do is, because they acquire an object, and then that position is recorded, and then the diver will go back and inspect it. So it kind of makes the process more efficient.
Around about this time, you're right, the branch was having trouble hanging on to its people. They were losing them to, you know, private military contractors instead. Mm. It's interesting to read that. I mean, obviously these contractors will pay much more than the Australian Navy can pay them to do this work. That's got to be damaging for the, you know, esprit de corps of the branch, doesn't it?
Well, it's not a very big branch, and so when you lose, you know, eight or so guys who have you know, gone through, you know, spent years getting to say the rank of petty officer or chief petty officer, you know, you lose a lot of, you lose a lot of your knowledge bank, you know, and that is in terms of your leadership and terms of your training as well. And so to make up that, it's going to take years to build guys up to that level to replace them, you know. Yeah.
There's a story in your book about Paul de Gelder, who's an amazing guy, went on the Navy diving course reasonably late in life, 28 or something, I think, thereabouts. Got through, was loving it, and then was on an exercise in Sydney Harbour, and he felt something thump against his thigh. Tell me that story, please, Gregor. What did he see?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. He'd made this concerted effort to get into the clearance diving branch, and he was a terrific terrific performer, and was now in an operational team in Sydney. They were testing a new sonar system, and so someone was on the ship with a sonar, and they were detecting the swimmers replicating a swim attack. And so he was sort of, you know, told to come in, swim to the ship, and then swim out to the Zodiac boat that he'd launched from. So he'd go in and back, and then they would test his equipment. And so I think on his second run in, he was just about 40 metres towards the ship again, and just felt this thump on his leg, and turned around, and there's this massive head of a bull shark.
What did he think? His first thing is, you know, go for the eye.
Yeah, and go for the eye, and he tried to use his right hand, but that was pinned in the shark's jaws. And so he said he went to try and get the eye with his left hand, but he had no kind of leverage, so it was a sort of a weak punch on the nose and that kind of stuff.
What did that do to the shark once he thumped it in the nose?
Well, didn't have the reaction he'd hoped. It basically bit down harder and soared through until it dragged him underwater. And then basically had severed a chunk of flesh out of the back of his thigh, and that's when he surfaced again, and realised that he was free, but he could see that his leg was at a weird angle. And by this time, the guys in the boat had reached him, and
so he was rushed to hospital. What did he lose from that shark attack?
He lost his right leg and his right arm, or his lower arm, just below the elbow.
Do you have prosthetics put in?
Yeah, so he's I think he's got a range of different prosthetics he uses for his leg, and has this very sophisticated prosthesis.
Yeah, robot arm almost.
Yeah. It's...
Given that all of his life had been about being physically, you know, astonishingly fit and capable and doing this extraordinary work, to have lost a forearm and a leg.
Mm.
What did that do to him initially when he was in hospital?
Well, he didn't really tell me about, you know, how deep his sort of blackness went, but I'd assume that he had some pretty dark days, and but I think how he has recovered and set his mind on achieving what he wants to do within the branch again has kind of, just his whole story has affected not only the people in the branch, men in the branch, but guys who have been through the branch. I think for the whole all Navy divers, all clearance divers, he's kind of he's a bit of a shot in the arm, I think.
What's
inspiration?
How has he stayed in the branch?
He does. He he's gone and redone courses that he had to reset courses in what he can do, and he trains young guys coming through in areas that he can
it's a training role basically.
It's a training role, and also he works with the compression unit, the underwater compression unit.
Gregor Salmon is my guest. He's written a history of the Australian Navy divers, the elite Navy divers unit. They've even done work in Afghanistan, which is amazing, which is a landlocked country, famously so, working dismantling IEDs there. Working with robots now increasingly. Does that take the larger part of the risk away from the job now for these men, working with robots, Gregor?
Well, to a point. The robots can... I think ultimately it depends on what the, you know, in terms of access. You know, if there's an IED, you know, out in the open on a road, then the robot can do a lot of the work. But sometimes it just doesn't. You can't get as far as you want with the robot. It has a tool that you can, you know, cut wires or dig and that kind of thing. But I think, you know, quite often it's going to be the guy has to walk downrange to the bomb and take care of it either by hand or do it, and at the very least do a kind of, you know, visual inspection close up. I don't think it's there. It's not replacing the bomb tech. It's a tool.
You kind of wonder when you read this book, you know, read and see what these guys do, how you'd go yourself in that situation. How do you think you'd fare with that kind of work, Gregor?
I don't think I'd have the stomach for it, really. You know, I think it's...
I'm saying this because you're a courageous guy. I know this. You know, you've been into Afghanistan. You've sort of written a book previously, that's what you came on the program before, about the poppy trade there. I think no guy does that, goes in to cover that without a sense of, oh, God, you know, my goose might be cooked any second now.
Oh, look, a common thread, I think, you know, talking with guys from Vietnam and guys from, you know, Afghanistan, is that, you know, you train to a certain level, you know, and you're highly trained, and those skills are kind of, you know, it's use it or lose it. So they're kept in a highly kind of, ready to use state of a skill. So I would, you know, so then they are sitting over a live mine, and I think what happens is that sort of your natural kind of instinct and your learning and training sort of comes to the fore. And most of them said, look, it was my job. I had to do it. I didn't feel particularly good about doing it, but they did the right thing. They all survived. And, you know, and that's the thing. Not one of these guys in Vietnam or in Afghanistan, you know, there's been one minor injury. Those guys have all survived. And so I'm not sure whether I'd be their first casualty, but I think, you know, I think it's a testament to their training that they, you know, that they get through it. So if I made the cut, then maybe I'd get through one or two.
Greg, great to see you again, and thanks for being my guest today in Conversation.
Cheers, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.